charismatic, passionate, has integrity, humble, servant, inspiring, faithful, persevering, positive, flexible, driven.
This is not about theory. This is about application. This is what you're trying to be. This is who we are that call ourselves leaders.
I'm Dave Ramsey, and you're listening to the Entree Leadership Podcast.
Well, welcome, everyone. I'm Chris Hogan. I'm glad to be back with you. Today, we're excited to welcome back a man that needs very little introduction. He is the author of The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, Death by Meeting, Silos, Politics, and Turf War. The last time he was here, we just scratched the surface of his latest book, The Advantage. Please welcome back to the podcast best-selling author Patrick Lencioni. Patrick, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. It's great to be here again.
Well, we appreciate you coming back. Now, listen, all month long, we have been talking about how to build a great team. And this is a topic that you've really covered from almost every angle as you've consulted and traveled the country and internationally as well. But the last time you were here, we just barely kind of scraped the surface of your book, The Advantage. So I'm glad to have you back to really tap into your knowledge base. Now, just as a refresher, let's talk about organizational health for a second, because my friend, you make a huge claim. You make a very big claim. You say that it's not only important, but organizational health trumps everything else in business. Do you mean that? Do you truly mean that?
I'm utterly convinced of it. And what I love is when these days when I'm out, as I was last week talking to groups of CEOs, even the skeptical ones now acknowledge this, because they realize that we've largely exhausted the competitive advantage in being smart. What I mean by that is, in the old days, and still today, people think that the key to having a great business is being good strategically or in marketing or finance or technology, all things that are very important, no doubt. But pretty much everybody knows how to do those things now. As I like to say, I have yet to go into an organization in the last 15 years and think, wow, this would be a great company if these leaders just weren't so dumb. People today have access. Information is ubiquitous.
Yes.
It's impossible not to have access to information. So people know how to do things in terms of the intellect. The problem is dysfunction and unhealthy culture in our organizations makes it impossible for us to tap into our knowledge. So the world is full of really smart companies that don't win because they're so dysfunctional. And then there's other companies that might not be quite as intelligent as their competitors, but because they create such a healthy, functional organization, they tap into it and run circles around their competition, which is why I say this: making your organization healthy is the single most important thing leaders have to do.
Wow. Okay, now how do you go about that? I mean, it's because I hear you, and I get it as you look at it, but what are some steps that you begin to take to try to get your organization healthy?
Well, there's four things, and they're simple theoretically, and they're hard to do because we're messy, fallible human beings. The first thing is we have to make sure, and as you've been talking about teamwork, that the people at the top of the organization, whether we're talking about the executive team of a multi-billion dollar corporation or the leaders of a small entrepreneurial venture or the head of a department within a company, the people that run a department, the leaders at the top of the organization that we're talking about, a church or a school would apply too, of course, the leaders at the top have to be behaviorally cohesive. So they have to do the five things that all teams must do.
Okay.
First, they have to trust each other at an inherent level. They have to engage in healthy, productive conflict around what they need to do. They need to commit to the decisions they make as a team. They have to hold one another accountable for their behaviors and performance around that commitment. And then they have to focus on results as a group, not on their own individual needs.
Mm.
So that's the first, all of those things we just talked about, that's the first discipline of creating a healthy organization. The team at the top has to be aligned. You also have to make sure that they are intellectually aligned, that they're on the same page, rowing in the same direction, if you will, and there's no ambiguity around the answers to six critical questions. There's six questions that any group of leaders in any organization has to answer as a group and be completely committed to those answers.
Okay.
Now, those first two steps, becoming a cohesive team and getting clarity around the answers to those questions, those two things have to happen first. If those are not done, the next two steps can't take place.
Okay.
The third step is once you answer those questions and you're really committed to those answers, you've got to go out and over-communicate those six answers. You've got to tell people throughout the organization over and over and over again, from in different ways and from different people, you have to constantly remind people of those answers. CEOs of organizations are actually CROs, their chief reminding officers.
I like that.
Their job is to go repeat themselves constantly, which is not easy for many leaders who find that to be redundant and wasteful. But that is the most important thing a leader has to do.
Hey, Pat, let me ask you this, because you're absolutely right. Because as a former business owner and as a leader, if I said something a couple of times, I heard me. Okay.
Yes.
And so I feel like that I may be treating people like they're stupid if I keep repeating this thing.
So, exactly. And in fact, it's exactly what you need to do. You know what they say? They say if people haven't heard something seven times, they don't believe it to be true. Seven times. And a leader repeats themselves twice, maybe three times, and they think you're right. They're insulting their audience or they're wasting time. But the truth is, we have so many messages coming at us, and often contradictory ones, and we need that leader to keep us focused. And when we've heard it the seventh time, you say, okay, now I get it. And, you know, people at Southwest Airlines hear from their CEO, Gary Kelly. He reiterates the same critical messages about keeping them on point. You know, great organizations like Chick-fil-A, Dan Caffey, his job isn't to make himself entertained when he talks. It's to keep people focused. Great leaders do this. And as I say, if your people can't do a good impression of you when you're not around, you're probably not communicating enough.
That's right. And here's the other thing, because as you're bringing in new people into the organization, the people that have been with you a while have heard you say it five times. But these new hires, you're just now beginning to inoculate them to the message.
Exactly. And before you know it, everybody surrounding them is repeating these messages, and you're really reinforcing it.
That's good.
So there's no such thing. Nobody leaves an organization because they've been over-communicated to. Nobody says, you know, I just can't stand it here. They keep telling me how important my job is and how important the customer is or how important innovation is, whatever it is in your organization. I just didn't want to hear it anymore.
No, that's good. I'm going to tweet you on that one.
So you build a healthy, you build a cohesive team at the top. You get clarity around those six answers. You over-communicate those answers. And finally, you have to put in place some structure to reinforce that. What I mean by that is some process, but just enough structure to institutionalize that clarity without bureaucratizing it. And what I'm talking about is structure around how you hire people, how you decide to let people go, how you manage people, how you reward them, how you train them, how you make decisions. Every process that involves people has to be designed specifically to reinforce those six questions and those answers. It can't be generic. It can't be borrowed from some world-class company's performance review system. It can't be so bureaucratic that people hate filling them out. You have to put just enough structure in place to reinforce your culture, your strategy, and everything else, and stop there. So if you do those things, build the team, get clarity, reinforce clarity through communication and human systems, you are golden. It is almost impossible to fail when you do those things.
Wow. Now, how what's an example of bureaucratizing it?
Well, many companies do this. They say, we need performance reviews. We need to do those. So let's get the lawyer and HR involved and a consultant to make sure we never get sued. And then employees sit down to go over their performance review with their manager, and they feel like they're catching them doing something wrong. It's like a punitive process, and it's too detailed, and it's not really about their jobs. The best performance review is regularly we have managers sit down with their employees and find out what their employees are feeling, keep the employees directed on the right thing, give them the resources they need, and remind them what they're doing well and what they need to do better. And it doesn't need to be connected to some technology system. It doesn't need to be connected to their pay. It's about keeping people on track. And so over-bureaucratizing that only makes it more difficult to complete, makes it more administratively cumbersome, and makes people feel like they're being caught doing something wrong.
Okay.
You know, the only time you need to start getting involved in that kind of stuff is when somebody's clearly not right in the organization, and you want to make sure you're documenting that to make sure that you're not exposed. But most people just want good coaching, and that does not require a lot of structure. It requires just enough structure to make sure people are doing it,
okay,
doing it consistently, and you're done.
Okay, see, that's good. That's a great tip for our small business owners out there. Because, see, I'd love to tap into your knowledge base and talk about how constructing a great team. You know, how do you build a great team from scratch? And one of the things in the book that you talk about that I think specifically applies to our small business owners is the gut feel versus structure.
Exactly. And let me say this to small business owners, because you're the backbone of our nation. And it's so fast. I love working with small businesses because they can make changes and really quickly turn their organization around. So here's the deal about small business. intuition is better than analysis. And structure is not always the right answer. But what I find is that a lot of small businesses, especially people who may have worked in big companies, say, listen, I don't want to have a bureaucratic company. I'm not going to do all that stuff. And I totally get that. And that's my nature, too.
Mm-hmm.
But put in place enough structure to reinforce your culture and keep it in place and keep it humming along when you're not necessarily there to reinforce it through your communication. Put just enough in place, and you're not going to encounter the kind of problems that many small companies face, and that's that they have no structure, and then when they start to feel the pain of having no structure, they over-implement something bureaucratic.
That's exactly right.
If they swing from nothing to too much.
To too much, yes, sir.
And that's why I always say put just enough in place and stop.
What's enough, Pat? What's enough?
Well, it's a great question, Chris. It's like this. So let's say hiring profiles, right?
Okay.
We worked at a company where you had to fill out all these forms and get all these approvals just to interview somebody, and then you had to fill things out and run it by HR and legal. And you think, nah, dang it, I'm a good hirer. I know a good person when I see them. So that's not enough. But I'll meet with them. I'm just good at intuiting this. And many small business owners think that. I know my company. Sit down and ask yourself, what are the two or three qualities that really makes somebody a good fit with me and with this organization, and really wrestle with that. And we go through this in the book. What are the kind of people that will not succeed here? Even if they're a good person, they just don't have the right values or the right personality. Once you articulate those things, put together five questions that everybody who interviews, anyone in the organization is going to answer those questions, ask those questions. And then you're going to debrief and really dig into it. So the structure is just a single sheet of paper with five questions on it and a place to take notes. Don't do it without any structure. Put just enough structure, one sheet of paper, and really follow it. The difference between nothing and that is huge.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
You do not have to make it bureaucratic.
Yeah, and here's the thing. All you have to do is let crazy in the door one or two times, and you'll really begin to believe in, yes, I do need to go a little bit deeper, you know, than just the eyeball test here.
And then you go hire some firm that's going to over-bureaucratize
that's right.
out of fear.
Yes.
So do just, you know, performance reviews are the same thing. People think, well, I don't do performance reviews. I'm just going to tell people. If I see them doing something well or not, they'll know it. I'll tell them. Of course, then they just don't do it. But the wrong thing to do is institute a 10-page form that you have to fill out, and they have to fill it out. You give them a rating, and everybody worries about the rating, and it affects their grade and how much they're going to get paid. And pretty soon it becomes this bureaucratic process. How about this? One piece of paper. Let's look at your goals. Let's talk about your performance. Let's talk about your behavior. Let's talk about my behavior as your manager. And Jack Welch used to have a great performance review system. He said it was one piece of paper, three questions, and somebody who worked for him said he filled out every inch of space on that. There was no white space left. See, the purpose of the process is to provoke the conversation regularly.
That's excellent.
So don't have the legal department do it or a lawyer. Don't necessarily have a bureaucratic HR department do it. You sit down as the owner or the leader and say, what do I want people talking about regularly? And let me give them just enough structure.
That's excellent. Now, listen, let's talk about how you approach a dysfunctional team.
Yeah.
Because you've owned this space and you've really helped people. And I think you've made a change in how people view this. But you said that keeping a relatively strong performer who is not a cultural fit sends a message loud and clear to the employees that the organization isn't that serious about what it says it believes.
Yeah, well, and Jack Welch talks about, he has this quadrant analysis that years ago that spoke to that kind of thing.
Yes.
I learned this myself in a painful way. So I had an organization before I started my own firm and started writing books and doing what I do now. I worked in a big organization, and on my team, I said that teamwork was the most important thing, and I believed it because I do. However, I hired this one woman, and she was very talented, and she got so much work done. It was amazing, Chris. I mean, she just cranked, but she wasn't a team player. And so you know what I did? I promoted her.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that what we do? That's what we do.
Crazy.
Yes.
Well, luckily, a couple of the people who worked for me, who still work for me now, they came with me and we started our firm. They came to me and they said, you know, Pat, you say teamwork's important, but she's clearly not a team player. So you have to ask yourself, are you going to change what you say or what you do?
Oh.
And I was like, whoa, they're totally right. Painful, right?
Yes.
So I realized I had a moment of truth there, and I took this woman. I tried to get her to be a better team player. It wasn't in her DNA. I helped her find another job in another part of this large organization that didn't have the same values as ours, but where she would be successful. And so I moved her on. You know, the lesson, Chris, is this. The performance of the people on my team improved exponentially when she was gone. See, what we don't calculate when we keep a strong strong performer but a bad cultural fit is the impact they have on the rest of the team.
Yes.
Look how many teams in sports get rid of that all-star player who was not a good team player, and they win more games the next year. It is just the way it works. If we value the collective over the individual, then we have to be willing to take a step back and lose a star performer so that the other performers on the team can become stars too.
Which is what you hit on right there is that addition by subtraction, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness. But you're subtracting because you know that it's not a fit. That's why a company has to know what it means to be a fit. You have to articulate what it means to be a good performer here, and that's not necessary. You know, I work with churches. And I say, how do you know if the person's going to fit well on your staff at the church? And people say, well, I mean, they love Jesus, and they, you know, if it's a Christian church, and so that's enough. And it's like, no.
Yeah.
That might be why they want to come there to worship. But you have to know the kind of personality you have, even as a church, because one church isn't the same as another, and one business is not the same as another, and one family is not the same as another. And if you have not articulated your core values, and you don't know how to find people that fit, and lovingly let people go who don't. So if you haven't articulated what it means to fit, tough to know.
Yeah, it's impossible. You know, now listen, I want to go backwards a little bit, because this whole area of organization health, I mean, you got to remember, I've gone to grad school, I've been to business classes, I've been taking courses, you know, all those things that you talk about, the strategy, the marketing, the finance, and technology.
Yep.
And now I read your book, and you're going to tell me, I'm playing devil's advocate here, Pat.
Please.
You're going to tell me that now organizational health, That is the thing that's going to help me take my business to the next level.
Yep. You know why? Because it is the multiplier of all those other things. You know, I started my career as a management consultant at a firm called Bain & Company, which was all about, you know, that all the smart stuff. But what I realized is I go to these companies, and we were helping them do analysis to make smarter decisions, but the politics in their organizations, they weren't even able to use some of the knowledge we were giving them. And so what I'm not saying is that this is soft or that all those traditional things aren't important. I've just come to realize that we can't tap into a fraction of the benefits of all those things if we aren't functional.
Okay.
And I have to tell you, other than some people, in theoretical people who have a hard time understanding this, anyone who's run an organization, when I talk to them about this and they hear the definition of a healthy organization, they say, oh gosh, I have to do that. That keeps me up at night. I know it's crushing us. I know it costs us money. Now, sometimes they get afraid because they think, I don't know how to measure it very well, and it's going to be emotional and unpredictable. And they're right. But the truth is, that's the only way to transform an organization these days, because you just don't find organizations that are stupid. You just don't find organizations that have no domain expertise. The real difference maker, and I'll tell you what, Southwest Airlines is not the best airline in America because they're smarter than their competition. I know that's hard to believe, but they don't have more PhDs and more industry experience and more sophisticated executives. What they have is a very good culture, a clear culture, and leaders who stick to it and have courage. And that is why. And they'll tell you that, and anybody who's been backstage at that company knows what differentiates them is the health of their organization.
Well, you had a phrase in the book that my wife came running in the room because I was like, yes! And she's like, what's going on? And I was like, you hit on this because I've consulted and I've worked with businesses, and you said in there that you have seen plenty of businesses with smart people, but they have a culture that is so unhealthy to sustain. It's too unhealthy, their culture, too unhealthy to sustain a successful business.
It's true. And you look at, there are a few unhealthy companies that have succeeded because the leader is so strong-willed that in spite of the dysfunction, they're the exception that proves the rule.
Okay.
But it's, you know, and people look at a few companies with very famous overbearing CEOs who win the day by sheer force of will.
Mm-hmm.
But they are the exception. For every company like that, there are these quiet, small, really successful companies that are doing exactly the right thing, where people love coming to work, their customers love doing business with them, and it's precisely because, and you know, so much of it comes down to treating people decently, having an intellectual and moral integrity, and being consistent around what matters.
Mm.
And when you do those things, success comes. It's not a very interesting or sexy story for the Wall Street Journal. You know, it really is more interesting when you have some flamboyant CEO who's kind of overbearing and creates controversy. And so that is what usually gets covered. But the truth is, the best companies are, at their core, there's organizational health, and it's based in great teamwork, clarity, and consistency.
Well, you put in the book, and again, I'd encourage everybody, if you have not read this book, get it. It's The Advantage. But you talk about with healthy companies that these are some of the benefits. They have minimal politics, high morale, low turnover, minimal confusion, and high productivity. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know a company anywhere on the planet that wouldn't sign up for those things.
Exactly. Well, they sign up for it, but then when they say, what do I have to do to get those? I'm like, well, you're going to have to argue more as a team. You're going to have to be more vulnerable with each other. You're going to have to enter the danger with one another and call each other out on behaviors and things that are uncomfortable and difficult. Sometimes leaders go, okay, let's go back and analyze the spreadsheet a little bit more. Because it takes courage and persistence more than anything else. And by the way, I have to say this. The Entree Leadership book talks about so much of this stuff. When I read his book, and we wrote it separately at different times in different contexts, there was so much in there that dovetailed with all this.
Yes.
I mean, and it's just no surprise because Dave understands the simplicity and the wisdom of simplicity in running an organization. And I've been out there to his place.
Yes.
And that's how it works. And people will say, is Dave the smartest guy in the world? It's more about his character than his intelligence. And that's just absolutely. And you know, when you listen to his advice for people, it's the same thing.
Yes, it is. And it is that common sense side. But let me ask you this, because I think you're right, that being willing to argue. Is there a fair way to fight?
Yes, and that is with vulnerability.
Okay.
If you're the kind of person that is vulnerable enough to admit when they're wrong, or to say they're sorry, or to acknowledge when someone else has a better idea than you, in other words, you've built trust with this other person, then you go at it with passion, and you know there's nothing wrong with that.
Okay.
Because even if you step over the line, which most people don't, we find, but even if you do, you can recover and, in fact, build a stronger relationship as a result. What we find that most organizations do is they have far, far too little conflict and not honest, open debate. And as a result, there's too much left to be said in the hallway and outside of the meeting.
Wow.
So what we say is this, argue passionately. You don't have to be Italian and Irish like me. I'm a pretty passionate debater. But you have to go in there and take a risk and say things that are a little bit uncomfortable. But because you know that you have trust with that other person and you're vulnerable, you're going to make good things out of it.
Yes.
It's going to be messy, and it's going to be uncomfortable, and nobody said that running an organization shouldn't be messy or uncomfortable. I honestly believe that's the biggest problem in business today, is that leaders will go into an organization and sacrifice their money, their family, and their health, which is terrible. But what they won't do is have uncomfortable conversations with people. And when they don't do that, it creates a lot of problems in the organization.
Now, listen, I want to bring it to some practical things for our listeners here, for our small business owners. And they hear you on this podcast and they realize, oh, my gosh, we've got to get healthy. I mean, we've got to begin to do some things. So can you give some practical steps on some things that they can begin, some things they need to start doing and keep doing to help get their organization? They're the owner. They can control it. Some things they can begin to do to help the organization to work toward getting healthy.
Yeah, first thing an owner has to do, a leader has to embrace this vulnerability concept. It keeps coming up again and again.
Yes, it does.
And that is, get in front of your people, and not in some false, touchy-feely, weird way, acknowledge to them your challenges, what you need to work on, and let them know that you're aware of that, and you want to get better at that, and you want their help. And when you do that genuinely, you do two things. First of all, you win their trust, because they're like, this guy or gal, she knows who she is, and she's not afraid to admit it. You see, they know, you know, people like to say, well, don't let your people see you sweat.
Yes.
They always know when we're sweating. So I think raise up your armpits and point right to the sweaty spot and say, check this out. And people will go, you're cool. You know who you are.
Yes.
So you'll earn their trust, but you got to be genuine. The second thing is you'll inspire them to do the same thing with you and with one another.
Okay.
A leader who cannot be vulnerable will not build that trust. So that's a very practical thing. Sit down with people and go, you know something? I don't want anybody here to think I'm not aware of my issues, and I want to put them on the table, and I want all of us to do that, but I'm going to go first. So that's one very practical thing. Skipping now, I would say the next very practical thing is rethink your meetings. And for big organizations, I think small organizations probably do it too, and I work with a lot of smaller companies, which I find even more fun. But stop having the one meeting that you call a weekly staff meeting where you're throwing every subject in the world under the sun into the same meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I call it meeting stew, where you take every ingredient out of the cupboard and put it in one pot, stir it up, and wonder why it tastes so bad. The truth is, if you have an organization, you need four different kinds of meetings instead of that one. And people go, oh, no, not more meetings.
Yes.
And I say, yes, more meetings, probably less time in meetings, but more importantly, the meetings are going to be good. You and your people are going to look forward to them, and it will be your best day of the week when you have your meetings. Now, there's four kinds of meetings you got to have, and I go over this in the book, too. One of them is I call it, and small businesses that don't do this, it's crazy. Most small businesses do. I call it the daily check-in. The daily check-in, Vern Harnish is a friend of mine. He wrote a book called The Rockefeller Habits. They call it the huddle. It's a little different in his methodology, but it's this. A great family needs to get together once a day for dinner. And a great team, especially if you're a small organization and you're co-located, which many are, get together for 5 minutes every day and just say, what's going on today? How are you doing? Did you watch the game last night? Hey, where's Fred? Oh, he's at a different meeting. He's off-site today. Hey, what's going on with that thing? 5 minutes, standing up, no agenda, no long-winded presentations, no PowerPoint. Just get together. If it goes more than 10 minutes, you leave the room.
Okay.
You don't turn it into a bureaucratic thing. Every day you get together. The second kind of meeting you have to have is what we call the weekly tactical. And that is where you just get together and talk about what's working, what's not, what do we have to get done this week, and what needs to change. You're not solving big questions. You're not questioning the strategy. You're not brainstorming. You're not doing any of that. You're just saying, how are we doing against our goals? What can we possibly adjust this week to hit those goals? And what are some issues we need to address in short time?
Okay, that's good.
The problem with that second meeting is that everybody wants to make it more sexy, and some big strategic topic comes up that they read about in the newspaper or a competitor's doing, and it gets diverted to some big, wonderful, important topic that should be handled separately in the third kind of meeting, which we call an ad hoc strategic meeting. And that is, you're in your weekly meeting and somebody says, hey, competitor XYZ is launching this new program. It could change everything for us. Heck, 6 months from now, it could put us out of business. Well, do not start talking about that at your staff meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You only have 15 minutes in between two other tactical things. Say, time out. Let's get on our calendar right now and schedule a 2.5-hour meeting tomorrow or the next day and really wrestle with this problem. Let's go into a room, get some pizza and get a few beers, roll up our sleeves, and solve this problem the way it should be solved. That is why we go into business, to solve these big problems. And when we try to do it in 10 or 15-minute increments during staff meetings,
mm-hmm.
all it does is ruin the tactical nature of the staff meeting and gives us not near enough time and context to solve that problem properly. So separate out your tactical business meetings from your strategic problem solving.
Excellent.
Huge. That might be the biggest thing. Our brains can't work in tactics and strategy interchangeably, and we leave meetings wondering why we hated it, and it's usually that.
Yeah. And if you look at these four type of meetings that you've laid out, you have that interpersonal connection with the check-in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where you find out what's going on with people's families.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes.
And then the next one is just running the business.
That's right.
The third one is taking apart those really big, hairy issues, that's why we get paid the medium-sized bucks to do that. The fourth kind of meeting is this, and this is critical that companies do it. Once a quarter, something about the way God made the world, you know, the seasons and everything else. Once a quarter, you've got to get out of the office with your team, and you've got to breathe. It can be a day, it can be a half day, it can be 2 days. I don't know. It depends on your business and what you're doing. But you got to get away from the business and breathe. Race car drivers figured this out when they said, you got to slow down in order to go fast. You got to slow down heading into the turn so you can accelerate coming out of it. And if you're like me, who's never really done race car driving, but I've been to Malibu Grand Prix, you know, where you drive around the thing,
uh-huh.
I floor it the whole way around the track, and I'm spinning out, and I'm screeching, and,
yep.
And my little kids are passing me because they know how to regulate. And when we run a business, if we think we have no time to slow down and get out of the office and review the team, the strategy, the competitive analysis, how we're all doing as human beings, when we don't do that, it's bad math.
Mm.
It's bad math. So the four kinds of meetings are daily check-in, weekly tactical, ad hoc strategic, and quarterly. That's the only one that I'm prescriptive about, the quarterly offsite where we step back and review.
And with that, are you out? We're having fun, right? It's not all work.
Yes, but it's actually the first priority is is work fun. In other words, you get in a room. My staff, when we do quarterly office, we have a blast, but it's around the business. And
okay.
We have lunch, and might go to dinner, but we're not golfing first and going drinking and taking the time in between. We are honoring the business and saying, if we're responsible for this business, how are we doing as a team? How is everybody feeling? Are those five dysfunctions creeping up? Are the values being held to?
Yeah.
Are we communicating enough? Does our structure need to change? And in doing that, there's fun. And then you relax a little too, and you can build in a little social time. But if you do the social stuff without the other, that doesn't work. You know, there's plenty of companies that socialize a lot, but they're still dysfunctional. And they might have fun golfing, and they might enjoy each other's company at a restaurant, but they don't necessarily perform.
Yes. Now, I appreciate that's excellent for the owner, but I want to go on the other side of the track. I want to say, let's say we're talking, we've got leaders listening into this that are working for some owners, and most of the leaders don't have the power or the authority to make company-wide changes. So what can these leaders be doing with their team or their department in terms to try to make them get healthier?
Yeah, that's a great point. So you're not the one in charge, but what can you do? Well, first thing I would say is don't assume that the leader you're working for that's doing something wrong, and all leaders do, we tend to assume that the leader is leading the organization exactly the way he or she wants to. In other words, well, if they manage that way, that's because that's the way they like to manage. Most leaders are just getting by. And frankly, they need all the help they can get. And though they'd like to get it, it's tough for them to hear it when people are just complaining or coming at them to be an activist. So what I say is this, assume that the leader that you're working for would like to be helped and to improve. And what they need is just someone to tell them the kind truth. You know, in my career, I was the guy that people would shove into the CEO's office. This is before I started my own firm. They'd shove me into the CEO's office and say, you tell him. And I always wondered why, because I wasn't even reporting to the CEO, and people that reported to the CEO would have me go tell him things. And I couldn't figure out why until one day I realized that I had learned how to tell people the kind truth, which has meant I wouldn't hold back the truth from what they needed to hear, but I'd say it in a way that honored them and the difficulty of their job, and they would say, I want to hear more from this guy.
But what are your secrets to doing that, Pat? How do you approach that?
You know, the secret is, and I, you know, my faith informs this, of course, as a believer in Jesus, and that is you've got to realize that all people are children. Older children, younger children, and they have a right to dignity.
Okay.
And so walking into even a CEO or a leader's office and saying, you're a big jerk, is neither fair nor productive.
Right.
The other thing, though, is it's really not a virtuous thing to tell people what they want to hear when it protects them from the truth. And so I think I just grew up, my dad kind of taught it to me, I came from a very unpretentious place, and I just thought, you know, if you speak the truth out of love, good things happen. And frankly, and then I got rewarded for it, and so I thought, of course this makes sense. So that's the first thing, is don't assume. And so go to them, honor the difficulty of their job, but help them see things that they might be able to do. Don't do it in a condescending way. The other thing is understand this. If you do that, very, very few people get fired for telling anybody the kind truth. Most times people get rewarded. At worst, they hear it, they don't change, and you'd still rather know that.
Yes.
Prayer, what's the serenity prayer, you know, God help me understand what I can change and what I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. And sometimes you go, that's a stumbling block, this guy, this gal is not going to change. And then you have a decision to make. You polish up your resume, or you accept their limitations.
Oh.
You know, but you don't accept their limitations and complain about it before you've tried to help them. The best thing you ever do in your career might be helping that leader. That might be why you become the next one.
Wow. That's
courage
big.
And love.
It is.
Courage
and those, that's big, because we have a lot of listeners that are out there that are working for other companies or, you know, working in the corporate world where they are lower man on their totem pole. You know, but being able to hear that and doing it, honoring the difficulty of that leader's job. And
you know, Chris, there's something else. Stephen Covey talked about the circle of influence and the circle of concern. What that means is this. Focus on what you can control and don't get too lost in the things you can't. Make your department so good that people are going to say, tell us what you're doing over there.
Yes.
People get so frustrated. Well, the CEO's not doing this, so what does it matter? Well, why would they listen to you or even ask your opinion if you're not doing it well in your area? So make your team so good, in spite of the environment, that people are going to say, we got to learn more from this one.
That's good. I like that. Focusing on what you can control is vital. Well, Pat, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I love your audience and what you're doing, and it's a breath of fresh air. I love that this is what I do for a living. I'm a kid in a candy store here.
Well, you do a great job. And again, we spent time talking to Patrick Lencioni. The book is The Advantage. Pat, thanks for taking the time out of your day to join us. I look forward to having you back on and diving deeper into to some of these areas that can continue to help business leaders grow.
Anytime.
All right, my friend. Take
God
care.
Bless. Bye
now. You know, I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation with Pat as he hit on it, the importance of being healthy as an organization. You know, as you look at this and you start to identify where you are as an individual, if you are a business owner, things that you need to be able to do to be able to help your company get better. And he hit on it. He was talking about as you move forward in those areas, you're smart, the strategy, the marketing, the finance and technology. But listen, as your team starts to get healthier, as your organization starts to get healthier, those things are going to grow and you're going to minimize politics. You're going to have better morale. You're going to lower your turnover. You're going to have minimal confusion and you're going to have higher productivity. When productivity goes up, we all know revenues go up. So I really appreciate Pat taking the time to spend with us. And I want you to continue to stay plugged in with us. As always, go visit EntreeLeadership.com. They have a lot of content and a lot of things that are continuing to grow over there with the newsletter. We've got to stay connected. Follow me on Twitter at ChrisHogan360. And if you have questions that you want Don and I to wrestle with here on the podcast, email us. podcast@entreeleadership.com. Send those over. Stay connected and join the conversation. So listen, stay plugged into this Entree Leadership stuff. Keep learning and keep leading. And until next time, grow yourself, grow your team, and grow your profits.